Cult Conference challenges Christian high school students to become the next generation of cultural leaders. Talks given throughout the week encourage high school students to put on the whole armor of God, engage culture, and advance the kingdom in all areas of life. Check out this year's Cult Conference by visiting calledconference.ninja. That's this summer, July 15th to the 20th, here in Moscow, Idaho. Sign up today for an early bird discount at calledconference.ninja.
Exactly. They are just as hopping mad, but they think, okay, we are allowed to be indignant because we are an established paradigm, and I don't care if they're polite or not polite.
Right.
They're just crazy, and I'm mad. Welcome to Darwin Denied, the Essential Bookshelf. It's my turn to introduce a book. And
a fat one.
A very fat one. It's called Signature in the Cell by Stephen Meyer. And you might be thinking, first off, as you just noticed, that this is very thick. And I don't want you to be intimidated by it. If you're interested in the debate, the creation-evolution debate, this is a wonderful book. It's in the we've talked about some of the taxonomy of these books. You've got some books that are intelligent design. Some are more just disillusioned with naturalism, but don't really pledge allegiance to any particular camp. They just have problems with evolution and then the creationist camp. This is definitely falls in the intelligent design camp, and it is a very closely reasoned, scholarly book showing the bankruptcy of materialism. Now, as a philosopher, is there, I mean, I use materialism and naturalism interchangeably. Are there any nuanced differences?
Yeah, there are nuanced differences, but I wouldn't worry about
it. Don't worry about
it. Yeah, there are differences. But
okay. But anyway, just showing that similar to the book that we discussed, Douglas Axe's book, Undeniable, this came out before that book, and it's longer, but he writes very clearly. If you have some kind of science background, that helps. You don't have to be a biology major. Just need to be maybe smarter than the average bear.
Okay.
But it's well-written. It's clear. And it, I think, pounds a lot of nails into Darwin's coffin.
Is it all microbiology? Is it all in the cell?
Well, the subtitle is DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. So it does talk a lot about the molecular realm, mostly because that is where the information is, and that's sort of the problem. And any naturalistic or materialistic approach to the origin of life is getting over that barrier of how do you have a undirected naturalistic process produce information, whether it's DNA sequences that are specified to code for very particular proteins that do things in the cell. So it is, but there's always informational analogies. So you don't have to know molecular biology to understand the arguments. He gets into probability and just shows that it's, if there's ever a time to use the word impossible, This is it.
Right.
I think that, like I said, it's pounding so many nails in Darwin's coffin that it just almost is an overkill.
And just to back up for a minute, in Darwin's day, this is somewhat in his defense, but
right,
you know, in Darwin's day, our knowledge of
the cell
was minuscule.
Yeah, just a blob of, you know, the cell could be a blob of jello.
Jelly-like stuff.
Yeah.
And nothing going on in there. It's just sort of the brick that,
yeah.
But there's way more going on.
Right. And they should have known it back then, even if they thought it was a black box, which Behe's book suggests it is a black box. But when you're a complicated multicellular organism, you can't think of these as bricks, especially if you're mm-hmm. doing stuff, thinking, moving, digesting. All of those are a function of the processes going on in the brick. So they can't be little blobs of jello, mm-hmm. Even if you don't know what's going on. Now we know a lot about what's going on in the cell. So this is just a marvelous book. And I just want you to know that even though you might be intimidated by its thickness, I'm a very slow reader, and I chipped away at it like a slow, determined woodpecker. But I didn't feel like I was ever bogged down. I felt like I want to keep reading. But then again, I'm a biologist, and I like this kind of stuff.
And so, on top of that, if you finish this book, Gordon will give you $10.
Well.
Well, maybe not. So I have a question
sure.
about this. So how much does he go in? How much of the book is focused on the question of information?
Yeah, most of it is on the question of information. And that, and so there's a lot of similarities with Douglas Axe's book, but I think he cites a lot of Douglas Axe's work in here, mm-hmm. showing that, you know, with your alphabet soup, the whole probability of coming up with any kind of cell is just, the probabilities are crazy and so tiny that they're laughable. Now, the thing that I wanted to ask you is, there's two rhetorical approaches that regardless of what camp you're writing from, mm-hmm. There's the...
You mean creationist or intelligent
design? Or intelligent design or the other.
Yeah.
Is you can take sort of a take-no-prisoners approach and sort of polemical. But most of the intelligent design books, because they're... I think they want to posture themselves in a very... reasoned, objective,
academic,
scholarly. They don't want to be poking anyone in the, mm-hmm. you know, doing the Three Stooges poke in the eye. So in this culture war, is this a good strategic approach? Because if you come at it reason, you know, this is DNA and the evidence for intelligence design. Or you can say this is an unassailable argument against the...
And you're a doofus for not accepting.
Yeah. One, you're immediately alienating your audience if you say something really, really polemic on the cover.
Sure.
But at the same time, if you're being super civilized, do they... I mean, it's almost like you, from their perspective, since they're sitting on what they consider this on the top of the wall of their fortress, thinking whether they're intelligent design, whether they're throwing spears or mm-hmm. whatever, whether they're being polite, whether not being polite, they give us the raspberry.
Yeah, I think in all mass movements, all mass intellectual movements, whether it's the Reformation or the Renaissance or mm-hmm. the revival of learning under Charlemagne and King mm-hmm. Alfred and people like that. Whenever you have a great mass movement, you're going to have all kinds of people. You're gonna have the scholars and the scribes who painstakingly make the case.
Right, and he does this. That's
and you need those guys.
Yeah,
you absolutely need those guys. But you also need the saloon brawlers. Mm-hmm. Who, you yeah. know, the cartoonists of the Reformation did a
right.
lot of, you know.
Yeah.
So
but
I don't...
But these guys say, hey, you're muddying the water. You're throwing dirt in the air. I'm trying to make a nice
reasoned case, and they're going to associate me with you.
Yeah, but I'd say if you look at the reaction the intelligent design people get, the evolutionists, the secularists, are every bit as hopping mad.
They are.
At those guys.
Exactly. They are just as hopping mad, but they think, okay, we are allowed to be indignant because we are an established paradigm, and I don't care if they're polite or not polite.
Right.
They're just crazy, and I'm mad. But if we get mad at them, I
don't think our saloon brawlers ought to get mad or screech or do things like that.
Right.
But I do think there's a place for polemical interaction.
Right.
Huxley was Darwin's bulldog, Darwin was a gentleman, and Huxley wasn't.
Right.
And they moved the ball that way.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question on the information side of this, and this is something I've not been able to get my mind around, and we might just demonstrate this for everybody, where everybody can watch me not getting my mind around something.
That's okay.
So when we say that the DNA, a DNA strand is a library.
Right.
Okay. It's got all kinds of information, and we say that because information can be transferred from one place to another place.
Mm-hmm.
All right, there's information transfer
when
the cell divides or when
there's all sorts of information. It's not just information; it's information processing.
Right,
and information becomes incarnational in the cell.
So here's the thing: if I had an intricate Swiss watch that I took the back off.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the design. There's all kinds of, but it's all cogs and wheels.
Right.
It's exquisitely designed, all cogs and wheels. I would want to say there's information there. Clearly there's information that went from the designer into the watch.
Right, but the information there is extrinsic to the watch itself.
Right.
It's the shape of the part.
It's mechanical. Mechanical information. So if you push this lever in, and the banana falls out, right? You're a monkey in the lab.
Right.
You've got, okay, there's mechanical information there.
Like the mouse trap in Behe's book.
But if you look at a sign on the wall, it says no smoking. That sign could be in English, it could be in Portuguese, it could be in Spanish.
Right.
Contain the same information but have a completely different configuration.
Right.
Because it's pure code.
Right.
It's just information.
But, right.
Right. Now, the question is the information in the DNA strand, is it mechanical information, pure information where God could have just written a completely different language and have the cell replication occurring in Spanish?
Right. I mean, he could have used maybe a different biological medium, but, you know, for whatever reason, he used these particular alphabetic letters we call A, G, C, and T, the genetic alphabet, four letters, to write code. Now, that code is just like ones and zeros or alphabetic letters in a text. It's code.
Do those letters get the effect that they get by going and pushing a button, or does somebody read it?
Something. Well, that's the wonderful thing about life is that the files, if you compared it to computers, there's these files need to be read. They're not not a static file. So on a computer, you say you've got a particular term paper on your in your My Documents, and you can double click on it and bring it up. In DNA, think of the file as DNA.
Okay.
You double click on it, and that you bring it up on your
your
monitor.
You access it.
That's sort of like RNA. And then when you click print, that's sending your document to, to the printer. Now I don't know how it works because I'm not into that IT world, but that document now is being read, and actually there's an incarnational aspect of the information. It comes out as a term paper on paper. Now, in the cell, you've got DNA. You've got all sorts of regulatory switches that either turn the file off or turn the file on. And each cell type, there's hundreds of different cell types in the body. And we're not just this one homogeneous mass of cells that
the
all
same
look
kind
alike.
Of cell, right.
All of these cells have are very differentiated, which means that all those cells have access different files. And the cell shapes are different. Why? Because different files have been opened. Every cell in the body's got the same genetic information, but liver cells are accessing liver files.
Okay.
And brain cells are accessing all the DNA that needs for that. And hair cells just keep on clicking on one file called keratin, and they just crank out keratin. Thankfully, they don't do that in liver because I've never wanted a hairy liver, but nobody does.
That would be bad.
That would be bad. So the information isn't static. It's being read, and it's being read differently in different cells. And
but
so these
it,
are the
is
big,
it being read? I guess my question is it being read or is it being read?
It's the way God made it is that He's there's no nano angels, I don't think, running around the cell reading it, but He has front loaded all of the information so that you've got enzymes that aren't thinking, but the enzymes hook onto these files.
Like a robot would read in
right.
like a robot would read something.
Or
in
like
a
printer reads your document. The printer's not thinking. The printer is just doing what it's designed to do. And a lot of the enzymes that run around reading files, RNA polymerase, replicating the, you know, DNA replication replicates all of the DNA in your cell so that each, when it divides, both cells get the same amount of information.
Is there an analogy to if I'm speaking?
There's always an analogy.
Is there a good analogy? If I'm talking on the phone or over Skype or something, I say something, the sound waves of my voice are translated into impulses, electrical impulses.
And then into sound again.
And then retranslated back into
sound,
sound at the other end. Is there something analogous here? Is the information translated into another form in order to be...
We've got some... In one sense, you can actually have DNA read into RNA, and it can be that's called transcription. So that's not a science word. The scribes of the Old Testament took the transcribed it. So you've got RNA transcription, but then you've got reverse transcription.
Okay.
So you've got enzymes that will take RNA and turn it into DNA.
Okay.
That's the only thing that comes to mind as far as going both ways.
How about
ways.
If I touch a hot stove? I touch a hot stove and information gets to my brain very quickly.
Right.
Right.
And then you respond. So this is the reactivity of the body, to stimuli. But in terms of where are you going with that?
Well, I'm trying to get my mind around, and still not quite gotten around the purity of the information.
Mm-hmm.
So the watch, it's mechanical information, clearly designed. There is the no smoking sign is clearly designed, but it's got to be decoded by either an intelligent observer or something that's been programmed to decode that.
Mm-hmm.
So if
someone could take apart a watch and look at all the measurements and make casts and make another watch based on looking at the
he could extract
and
the
we could go in and sequence the DNA and actually in the lab we can make artificially hook nucleotides together based on copying the information in the cell. But
so the the question is, could someone say, I'm trying to anticipate, let's say you got an honest evolutionist who actually tried to grapple with how staggeringly complicated this all is. He's going to have to, since there is no spirit and is no mind and there is no information in his world, it's just blind chance fumbling through the corridors of time.
Right.
Right. It's a concourse, great concourse of atoms going down.
Right. But right now we've got a very, very complicated.
Right. So he's going to have to explain all these complicated things that happen.
Right.
In terms of mechanical
and
pushing and pulling.
Yeah. You can't. If you're talking about just a static, non-living world where the matter is matter, then you have to just deal with how did this matter come to be, assuming that there was nothing and then that matter came to be. That's one problem. But having materialistic, naturalistic causes generate information is the insurmountable. That's where I would be a little bit more
aggressive,
just because, like, even with Behe's book, the subtitle is Darwin's Black Box, a biochemical challenge to evolution. I would say insurmountable
challenge.
Insurmountable barrier to evolution. Now, the reason they don't generally pick things like that is because them's fighting words. Mm-hmm. Those are words that will raise the ire of your opponents. And you want to have some dialogue. Generally, they're not willing to dialogue much anyway. But I wanted to just mention the kinds of probabilities. Just one, a couple of my favorite chapters are Ends and Odds, and the one after that, Beyond the Reach of Chance, where he really, really goes into showing how even given a big, big primordial soup in the amount of time, even given the evolutionary cosmological time frame of 13.7 billion years, which is what they would say the Big Bang occurred, given that amount of time, given amount of matter in the universe, and given just assuming that all of that matter is devoted into unguided processes banging the matter together in no intelligent way, to get amino acids together, again, going back to some of the Doug Axe stuff, getting the amino acids sequenced to form informational strands that fold up into protein origami that does things.
And they're right-handed and left-handed.
Left-handed amino acids. Yeah. And you've got to have not only the amino acids hooking together, getting them hooked together in the right way, never mind whether it's informational, just getting them hooked together so that you have a string of Scrabble letters all oriented right. Never mind whether it says anything. Just get them, the Scrabble little platform.
Yeah, all right side up.
Get them all right side up in the right orientation. Just getting them like that is astronomically low probabilities. Now, to have expelled something, you're getting into numbers that just you can't even get your head around. I can't get my head around the number of atoms or molecules in a drop of water. That's 33 billion times a billion in a drop. Mm-hmm. Now, 10 to the 80th is the number of subatomic particles in the known universe based on what they know, 10 to the 80th. Now, the way exponents work is 10 to the 81st is 10 times 10 to the 80th. 10 to the 82nd is 10 times 10 to the 81st, and so on. Yeah. So it's exponential increase with each,
iteration.
And so when you're talking about just one protein, of a very modest length, just a modest length, never mind a cell, but just one protein of 150 amino acids, the chances of it forming by chance and have it be of a biological, having it have some biological significance. It it has, it's biologically functional, is just one chance in 10 to the 164th power. Now, that's just one protein.
That's pretty small.
That's one protein. Now, remember, 10 to the 80th is the number of subatomic particles. You say, well, you know, given enough time, there's been 10, given 13.7 billion years, that's 10 to the 17th second. No, 10 to the 16th seconds.
Okay.
13.7 billion years is 10 to the 16th seconds. Now, you're talking about...
Not only that, you're using your Scrabble analogy. You've got what are the odds of getting all the tiles right side up in a row?
In a row, and it's spelling supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
And it spells delicatessen the other way.
Right. Well, palindromes and all sorts of things. But this is the thing that's a little bit different in apologetics. You know, when you're having an actual fight, you can see a winner, you know, you can have a knockout. Sometimes it needs to be arbitrated. You have to have judges. But on things like football, basketball, everybody knows when the ball goes through the hoop.
Yeah.
And for most part, you know that, you know, the running back went into the end zone. It's a touchdown. And everything's so physical and concrete, everybody can say there's no argument. But when you give slam dunk arguments like this, where it's different than a knockout punch. It is a knockout punch, but with ideas, it's not as physical. And so, like, it's more like chess.
And you refuse to take the point.
You refute. Well, it's like you put your opposition. I feel like this has put Darwinism in checkmate many
times over.
Many times over, and along with other books. But it's like your opposition, there's nothing about the pieces on the chessboard that knock the king across the room. The opposition has to agree to the lines of force.
Yeah.
Your bishop and everybody, you've got it in checkmate a bunch of times over.
And as long as they're saying, nuh-uh.
They just say, nuh-uh. Right. And you can do scholarly work saying, yeah, huh. Yeah. But whoever's got the high ground as far as the, you know, the paradigm, the institutions, most people will say, well, they said, nuh-uh, and that's good enough for me. And most people don't want to do the homework and go, wait a minute, what are the lines of force in chess? What's a good, solid argument that just devastates them? This devastates them, but they're not willing to roll over,
right?
Because it's a matter of ideas, and those ideas, it's like you put them in checkmate, and they go, and they flip the board and go, I win.
Right.
And you go, well, I can't. Yeah. No matter how scholarly I am with that, you just... That's just sad. It's sad. But we need people that write books like that. I wanted to say one thing that we didn't mention with the Doug Axe book is that some of the ID books don't really, they'll make a very good case for intelligent design, and I think most people just go, okay, fill in the blank, it's pretty obvious. The thing that I wanted to mention with Doug Axe's book is he didn't shy away from God,
right?
And he said he was a Christian, and so it was very, very clear that this is not some generic God
force
or anything like that. This is Jehovah. This is God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I appreciated that. Not that they have to do that, but anyway, don't be intimidated. This looks like an iceberg. And it has the same effect as icebergs did on the Titanic, if you think of the Titanic as Darwinism. So
thank you.